Thank you very much, Sue. Our next case is case number 822-0960, State of Minnesota versus John Ishmael Bradley. As all parties are aware, the state will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. The appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, respondent will have 15 minutes, and then finally, counsel for the appellant will have 15 minutes. Whenever you're ready, just begin and tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning, Your Honor, Your Honor, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Greg Scanlon and I represent John Bradley, who's the appellant in this matter. Mr. Bradley was convicted of second degree assault and of enhanced felony domestic assault. We are asking this court to recognize that this single blow with a 1-inch wide broom handle is not sufficient to establish the dangerous weapon element of second degree assault. We are asking this court to recognize that the cumulative effect of the evidentiary errors in this case was not harmless, and that to say otherwise would create open season for prosecutors to prove assaults without any substantive evidence having been admitted. We are also asking this court to recognize that a person cannot be convicted of two assaults for a single act of assault against one person. I want to start with the second-degree assault and the dangerous weapon element. The facts in this case are not in dispute, and I think we also agree that the only way the dangerous weapon element could have been established is through the manner of use. Was the manner in which the broom handle was used calculated or likely to cause great bodily harm or death? And The case law on this, Basting is the lead case, and it is reviewed as a matter of law. That's the holding in Basting, which is a 1997 case. And it calls upon the court to examine. Yes.
You argue that the review is as a matter of law, but aren't you really arguing that the evidence isn't sufficient to meet the definition of a dangerous weapon?
I am. I'll confess that I'm not sure what Basting means exactly by as a matter of law, because I don't think it requires any less deference to the findings that the jury must have made. I think it's just a question of the court taking some additional care with this particular type. It really only applies in manner of use cases, just to make sure that everyday items aren't sort of blown out of proportion, and it's sort of kind of keeping some reins on what exactly can count as a dangerous weapon. So yeah, I'm saying it's not sufficient. It wasn't sufficient in this case to show that the way that he used it was likely or calculated or likely to cause great bodily harm or death. And again, Basting tells us to look at, you know, what was the nature of the assault? What was the nature of the interaction? Was there a size difference between the two of them? Was there any vulnerability that was exploited? Was there pursuit? Were there words exchanged? And this was a very short incident. It was one blow and then he ran off.
Didn't Mr. Scanlon, to follow up Judge Cochran's question, so if we assume, therefore, since you didn't object specifically to the instruction on dangerous weapon, that if we're in the sufficiency of evidence arena, then we will defer to the jury's, will look most favorably to the fact finder in this case, right? And so that being the case, isn't it true that it really matters not legally length of time, but just what occurred during the time that it took? Same with a blow. Doesn't the law doesn't require more than one blow, but a blow on with an item that as used has that likelihood, the probability as defined in the statute. So what I'm not understanding is almost seem like you're asking us to do some form of a de novo review, but if you concede that it's not a legal question but a sufficiency of evidence, aren't we deferring to the jury? And the facts seem in place here given the 6-centimeter size impact on the top of her head and the jury's finding.
Well, a jury found Mr. Basting guilty, and the facts of that assault were worse than what we have here. The injuries were certainly worse. That victim had, besides a cut on the face, also had a broken nose. And so I don't think that, again, with manner of use, if this were a firearm, it would be different. If this were something designed as a weapon, it would be different. Even if it was an intended use case, it would be different. But again, Basting has told us in certain cases, we're going to find as a matter of law, despite a jury's determination to the contrary, we're going to find that this isn't enough. And in Basting, they said it's not enough. And here it's less than Basting, so it's not enough. I do think it's different than the typical deferential standard of review for sufficiency of the evidence. I think Basting has said so. Now, is the Supreme Court still going to say so? I don't know. I mean, there aren't any cases that I could find. There aren't any second-degree assault manner of use cases after Basting that have gone to the Supreme Court. I did point out some non-precedential Court of Appeals cases that do this as a matter of law, with a manner of use case as a matter of law, and they do so despite a jury verdict. Or I think maybe one or two of them might be a guilty plea case as well, which where the standard is essentially the same. And so I do think that there is less deference to the ultimate determination that the jury made on that element in this particular manner of dangerous weapon cases.
Can I pose it from a different direction, Mr. Scanlon?
Sure.
If we disagreed with you on that point, would you then concede that because we would have to give deference to the jury that there was sufficient evidence here that the broom handle could have caused, perhaps not calculated because we assume a broom is calculated to sweep, but the handle under the use here has the likelihood of producing the requisite harm?
Well, so I don't think the evidence is sufficient. The evidence in this case is sufficient to establish that one blow with this particular broom handle, that one blow is sufficient or is likely or calculated to cause great body harm or death. And I would caution the court, there is a lot of conflation in the case law. There's a lot of misunderstanding of the language that's used in these different iterations of dangerous weapon. It's not could it have. We only consider whether something is capable of causing great body harm and death or death when it's designed as a weapon. If these were brass knuckles that caused this injury, absolutely a second degree assault, absolutely a dangerous weapon, because brass knuckles are designed as a weapon and brass knuckles are capable of causing great body harm or death. So it doesn't matter what you do with it. It only matters what actually happens with something that is an everyday item, that something that is not designed as a weapon and something that's not a firearm. It's very different. So it's not could this thing have caused great body harm or death? It's also, and calculated does not mean design. Calculated just means likely or it's sort of in the same ballpark is likely. It's probability. Are you creating a risk of great bodily harm or death?
And Mr. Scanlon, would your argument be the same if instead of a broom handle, it was a baseball bat?
I think it would be harder for me because I think a baseball bat. I mean, there obviously is a lot more force in a baseball bat given the size of it compared to a broom handle. I think they're also, if you do look at the function of the item, a baseball bat is meant to hit things very hard and to do so solidly. It's meant to have some girth and some weight and some force to it. A broom handle is meant, it should be lightweight. You're carrying it around the house sweeping. It should be a little bit flexible even in the way that, you know, some hockey sticks are, just to kind of give you a little bit of torque at the bottom of the broom. And so there are some basic differences. And obviously, I mentioned the size and probably the strength of the wood involved. Again, there isn't a whole lot. Go ahead.
Are you familiar with the State v. Upton case where the Supreme Court concluded that a pool cue, that the evidence was sufficient to support the jury finding that a pool cue was a dangerous weapon?
I do remember reading that case. I didn't have that on my short list of cases to discuss today, I'm sorry, I don't, that's fine, I was just gonna ask
you know,
go ahead,
how this case would be distinguishable from that case, but that, you know, that is a 1981 case, so that's fine. But I guess, you know, given the facts of this case where the blow was to the top of the head, and isn't that, and you know, there's testimony by the victim saying that, you know, it was a severe blow, that it could have killed her. Don't those facts make this case distinguishable from Basting, where it sounded like it was more kind of a, you know, a direct punch to the face versus a severe whack over the head, for lack of a better term?
Well, ultimately you would have to distinguish Basting. I don't know if two punches to the head in the face, as opposed to a single strike on the top of the head with a broom handle. And again, the injuries in Basting are worse. The only thing you need to know about whether the assault in Basting was more forceful or more dangerous is it actually caused much greater harm. There's nothing here except broken skin on the top of the head. I get that it's the top of the head. And if you hit the top of the head with, as Judge Conley suggests, with something like a baseball bat or a crowbar, sure.
But Mr. Scanlon, is that legally relevant to the analysis? Because the whole point of likely to produce means it doesn't necessarily produce it. Am I correct?
How does
the fact here that didn't happen answer the question whether the jury's verdict was sufficient? Evidence was sufficient for the jury's verdict.
Well, because likelihood is determined, has to be at least logically connected somehow to what actually happened. I mean, if you did this and there was no harm at all, it's hard to get there beyond a reasonable doubt that, oh, well, even though it caused very little damage, it actually was very likely to kill somebody. Judge Cochran mentioned the complaining witness's testimony that, oh, she said she thought it was going to kill her. That, by the way, is not substantive evidence in the case, because it only came in by way of her out-of-court statement. On the stand, she said that she didn't think it could have killed her. And in any event, she's not qualified to make she's not an expert. If they had, you know, some sort of weapons expert or someone who's strengths the materials or understands physics or whatever, maybe they could have established. I mean, it is the state's burden. It's the state's burden that, despite not coming close to anything like great bodily harm, that doing exactly what he did is likely to cause it. And I think it's just not possible here to reach that conclusion beyond a reasonable doubt, which is what I think the court is required to do. I did want to have a little bit of time to talk about the evidence in this case and the evidentiary errors. I do think that the power and control evidence is plainly erroneous and was objected to anyway. And in fact, I make the point in the brief that when it was objected to for relevance, the court said, well, we haven't gotten there yet. The next question was about what happened on January 13th. And so it made it look like the relevance is, well, it's relevant because he assaulted her, which is exactly how it's not allowed to be used. And then the prosecutor accentuated that in closing argument in a way that the state concedes was improper. And when you add on top of that, I mean, it's very, very hard in this case, even if all of the out-of-court stuff was admitted, unless it was admitted under 807, which the state hasn't even made an argument other than to say it could be 807, hasn't made an argument that any of it comes in under 807. And otherwise, it's none of that is substantive evidence. It's impeachment evidence only. And when you add all of that together with the power and control evidence, with the judge's bonkers instruction about lying witnesses and how you shouldn't believe anything. If you don't believe what they say, then you can take anything else that they've said and use that. There just was a lot of stuff out of the norm here, even far and beyond what we often see.
I guess, Mr. Gatlin, I mean, on the power and control evidence, why wasn't that relevant to explain the recantation, which then would be relevant to impeach her current testimony? I mean, why is that not logical, what I just said?
Well,
apart from whether or not he's qualified to give the testimony, but assuming that he is, why am I wrong?
Well, because for one thing, there isn't substantive evidence of any sort of prior assaults that would have caused her to be fearful or for there to be this whole power and control dynamic. Again, it's an ongoing thing where he's using threats and assaults in the past to kind of control conduct in the future. And she testified that he'd never assaulted her before, that he didn't strangle her. The only way that came in, again, is through the statement at the hospital. And even then, when she describes it briefly, the officer says, oh, so he has hurt you before. And she says, well, no, that didn't hurt. So, and that's the entire scope of their prior conduct involving him and her. And that is somehow creating this power and control dynamic. It just isn't there. They don't have evidence of it. They're just assuming that it's like every domestic everybody's ever heard of. And I see I'm out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Scanlon. You will have time for rebuttal. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Aaron Welch. I'm assistant county attorney in St. Louis County. This case arose in the Virginia courthouse, which is where I've been assigned for the last couple of years. On Monday, I was just reassigned to Hibbett. So I'm actually coming to you from Hibbett, but I'll go back to Virginia. Well, you don't care about that.
I do. I think they're both really cold right now. So I'm sorry for both places.
That I have no objection to that statement. On the dangerous weapon issue first, I think the case law is really, really clear that whether or not something is a dangerous weapon is a question of fact. There are individual cases, to be sure, where the court has reviewed it and determined on our review of this, under these facts, as it was used, it wasn't a dangerous weapon. And you can say that that's as a matter of law, I suppose. I think I'm actually kind of embarrassed. One of the cases I didn't cite in my brief was the Coet case, which is 601 Northwest 2nd 443, which is a really, really instructive case on this whole issue. The question in that case was, someone had shot someone with a paintball from a paintball gun and whether or not that was a dangerous weapon. And the court broke it down really well. They said, okay, well, there's three questions. First, was it a firearm? And they decided, no, it's not a firearm. So if it's not a firearm, we take that part off. The second one, is it a dangerous weapon as designed? And they decided, no, it's designed for recreation and all these things. It's not designed as a dangerous weapon. So then they said, was it a dangerous weapon as used? And in this case, the person got hit, I forget where, on their body, but they said, that's not dangerous as used. But if it had been used, and they give an example of shooting someone in the face intentionally, that might make it a dangerous weapon. What they don't say, but what can very clearly be extrapolated from that, is if I take the paintball gun and hit someone over the head with it, it's going to be a dangerous weapon. And it's the manner of use. And in this case, taking a solid stick and hitting someone on the top of the head hard enough that it splits the skin on the top of their head open, I don't know what else that could be. I use the example.
Mr. Welch, I'll interrupt you and welcome from Hibbing. I wanted to ask you about that phrase in Basting, because obviously it does affect your client's position, the state, in terms of how we look at that, because literally, if we mean that to be a matter of law, de novo sort of review, well, then the three of us would give our thoughts on this record and whether that broomstick is likely to produce that versus our standard sufficiency of the evidence analysis, which in which case we wouldn't. We'd simply defer to the jury's findings. So what do you make of that statement in Basting as a matter of law, and how, what's your best argument for why it doesn't mean what it means in terms of what we review here today?
Sure, thank you. So I think the issue in Basting and the issue that was deemed to be a matter of law is actually really, really, really discreet. And one of the factual findings of the court was that because Mr. Basting was a professional boxer, therefore his hands are dangerous weapons. And what they said is, no, that what the court of appeals said is no, that's not enough. You got to look to all this stuff. You can't just say that because the guy's a boxer, because he was a Marine, because whatever, his hands are dangerous weapons. I think that's what they were saying was decided as a matter of law, that on its own is just simply not enough to show that. The other thing I think that, if what is ultimately decided is that whether any individual item that is used in a case where second degree assault is charged is a dangerous weapon as a matter of law, what that is going to do is turn the Court of Appeals into a mini legislature. And we're going to have 200 decisions for every conceivable thing anyone ever assaults someone from. And you all will have to decide de novo, is it a dangerous weapon or isn't it a dangerous weapon? And I don't think that's what the Court of Appeals wants to be in the business of. But I think if ultimately that's the decision, that's what's going to have to happen, because the legislature gave us a definition. But if we ask you all to specifically go through and do that every time we have a new object that's used to hurt somebody, you're going to be real busy. So that's what I make of that argument, and that's what I'm going to make of the matter of law statement. That's what I think that was driving towards.
Mr. Welch, could you move on to the evidentiary issues?
Certainly. I think that, as you all know, trying domestic violence cases are incredibly difficult for any number of reasons. And one of those reasons is because of the dynamics, the interpersonal dynamics that are at play in violent domestic relationships. I don't need to tell you all about that, but I mention it because that's the background to all of this. When it's far more common for me to get
then,
a domestic.
Then if that's the case, why didn't you get a, expert on battered women's syndrome to testify regarding the unique dynamics between an abuser and a victim?
I could have done that. And in retrospect, I should have done that. And I shouldn't have had this relatively inexperienced officer talk about that. That was an error. That was just a miscalculation on my part. I mentioned that in my brief. That said, the discussion of power and control was incredibly minimal. I mentioned it once in closing using those words. And I pointed to the, just to kind of hop ahead in a second to the harm, I pointed to the, now I'm blanking on the name, I apologize. The Rose case Miller, that I cite in my brief, that indicates that even where there's no testimony, no substantive testimony about power and control anywhere during the trial, and the prosecutor talked about power and control in closing as a way of explaining the evidence, kind of what Your Honor had indicated right at the end with Mr. Scanlon about, well, isn't that relevant to how all this came about and why she might be recanting? They found that was okay. And so the only way having that officer answer those couple of questions is enough of an error to justify sending this back to district court is if just by the fact of her wearing a uniform and saying those words is enough to taint the whole thing. Because if I hadn't asked those questions, I could have made the exact same closing argument. And at least under Miller, that wouldn't have been a problem. With regard to
Mr. Welch, I'm going to narrow it down just a little bit. I do note, and Mr. Scanlon brought this up, that in your brief with regard to the reason why the evidence was properly allowed and substantively, not just as impeachment, as you do reference 801D, 804B, and then finally 807. That's what I'll ask you is, give us your best 800 rule that the court, although the court didn't elaborate, as I see the record, at one point 634 was brought up. I think you interrupted and the judge read an instruction, but there really wasn't your typical analysis and there wasn't any pretrial rulings, I don't believe, on, at least on the texting, there was at the hospital, but not the phone calls and texting. So which rule do you believe is your best argument for why the evidence was properly allowed?
I think going through those, certainly first, anything that Mr. Bradley himself said that's relevant to the case comes in as statement of a party opponent. So all of those things, there's no argument there, I don't think. I think the best argument is probably the 807 argument. And I think the best argument under 807 is essentially this. You know, what I was taught and what I teach my students when it comes to talking about relevancy and hearsay exceptions especially, is the reason we have the hearsay exceptions we have is because over time, courts have decided that these are situations that lend credibility, that because of how someone says something or where it's noted down or the situation, it has that relevancy. It has that indicia of reliability. So, you know, with the 807 argument, I think it comes down to that so much of these things she said initially and then testified to differently at trial is under the notion of that it's not in her interest, that it's against her personal interest, her pecuniary interest in her relationship. Now, I know that Mr. Scanlon points out that, you know, in the discrete period of time immediately after the assault, she's not aligned, so to speak, with Mr. Bradley. She's angry at him. She wants to call the cops. She wants to say what happened. She wants bad things to happen. And that goes on for a couple of days. There's 2,000 text messages that show this going on. And I think writ large, the entire situation, both of what occurred before the assault itself and in the weeks and months after, shows that she was in this long-term on-again, off-again relationship, which is the nature of these things. And when she's sitting there in court that day and he's standing there looking at her, and when you read the text messages, he's clearly managed to get her to the point where she's going to say other stuff.
Mr. Welch, you know, under the rule 807, and I did not ever teach evidence, but I always try to just remember it as well. Since you can't get it in under the 8 million other exceptions to the hearsay rule, you can always try 807, which does require notice. Now, did you give notice about these things coming in? Because presumably you knew she was recanting and you wanted them all in.
I didn't know what she was going to do, honestly. I didn't know if she was even going to show up, hence why I drafted a memo prior to trial in case she didn't appear to ask for the stuff to come in as forfeiture by wrongdoing. You know, we had contact with her. She never once said, and this is not on the record, and I apologize, but I'm just trying to give background to answer your question. She never said it didn't happen. She just said, I think what's happening is too much. I don't want him to be prosecuted. It's blown out of proportion. But she never said it didn't happen. And she never said it didn't happen even in her testimony. She would say, I don't remember. I don't recall. I'm not sure. Those kinds of things. So with the 807, I guess the point I was just trying to make is that if we can't come up with another specific thing, we can do it with that. And my theory there is that's the statements against interest. And as far as notice goes, defense was provided with everything, with the videos, with all the text messages, with the jail calls. I mean, they had all of that stuff there, and I had conversations. So if what you're asking is, did I file a specific separate motion saying here or notice, I don't think I did, other than perhaps contained within my motions in limine. But certainly there was actual notice and these things were discussed. There wasn't any surprise there. The only surprise at trial was that there was this third video, which no one had ever heard of. And then, oh, we dealt with that. I hate that stuff. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
Counsel, just briefly, if the power and control evidence was erroneously admitted, what's your best argument that it didn't significantly affect the verdict? I know you kind of touched on that earlier, but given, you know, the situation with the alleged victim and her wavering in testimony, why didn't it? Why isn't there a reasonable probability that it significantly affected the verdict?
The answer to that question, I think, is are Mr. Bradley's statements throughout the phone calls and the text messages. It's very telling, in my opinion, that never once does he say, you got to tell the cops the truth that it didn't happen. That's not what he says. What he says is, you got to get me out of this. You got to get me out of this. You're the only one that can help me. That. And I think that when the facts of the case are brought out, the photos, the testimony, and then you have his statements where even he's never saying, I didn't do it. He comes up with a bunch of excuses if you put all that together, there's no way the jury would have come to a different conclusion. That's what I think is the best argument for why there's no harm ultimately in the jury's verdict. So thank you all very much.
Thank you. Mr. Scanlon, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you. I did look at Upton, and I do recall Upton. The problem with Upton is that there's no discussion. They describe the facts very briefly, and they say it's sufficient. And a lot of those cases from the early 80s do so. Elkins, Names, Lott, Bourne. There just isn't the discussion of this particular issue until Basting. As far as Basting creating a problem for the Court of Appeals, it was decided in 1997, and there have been no Court of Appeals cases, well, very few anyway. There's been, the three that I cited that have to do with second degree assault and as a matter of law, whether or not it meets the element. It could also be that Basting gave the direction that was necessary, and people aren't charging second degree assaults where it looks like it's not as serious as Basting. This case was overcharged, which incidentally was the position of Mr. Bradley, who said in a phone call that he would take a lesser charge, and the position of the complaining witness in her contact with the prosecutor's office. I don't think these charges are right. I don't think she's saying, I don't want him, he shouldn't go to prison for this, not for this assault. As far as the power and control, remember, this is a cumulative evidence argument. And so I happen to think that the power and control on its own, because there wasn't an expert, because it was applied to Mr. Bradley, despite there being even evidence for it, I think it alone is enough. But again, we're talking about cumulative evidence here, so all the errors should be considered together. On the 807, again, the state didn't provide a written argument in respondent's brief. I would encourage the court, I encourage you to look at Robinson. And this is what I did in my brief. Look at Robinson and look in there about their 807 analysis and what factors they consider and what facts related to those factors weigh in favor of admission. And I don't run down all the facts of Robinson because it's a long case, but I do kind of a side-by-side comparison. I go through those same factors in this case. The same factors that Robinson looks at, And I explain how they are not present when they are not present in this case, and explain why 807 wouldn't apply. Besides the fact that the against interest only applies, a statement is only reliable if it was against interest at the time the statement was made, not if it's against interest at some point later in the future. And Van Gravenhoff is clear about that. I think those were my follow-ups. If the court has no other questions, I would yield my remaining time.
Seeing none, we will issue our opinion within 90 days, and the matter is now submitted. Thank you very much, Mr. Welsh. Thank you very much, Mr. Scanlon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.